movie theaters too. VOA won the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you'll find out how some American universities are working to keep smoky flavors out of your wine. Then, Ana Mateo gets us all ship-shape in this episode of Words and Their Stories. Finally, Kelly Jean Kelly brings you the next part of our report on the president known as FDR. The West Coast of the United States produces over 90% of America's wine, an alcoholic drink. However, the area is also prone to wildfires. Such fires cost the American wine industry billions of dollars in 2020. The smoke affects the flavor of the growing grapes that later become the wine, and the flavor is undesirable, say some wine drinkers. So, wine experts from state universities in the area are working together to protect wine grapes from wildfire smoke. In 2020, economists say wildfires caused billions of dollars of losses, which included the wine industry. As a result, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is paying for grape research at some state schools. The schools include the University of California, Davis, Oregon State University, and Washington State University. The research investment is worthy, agriculture officials say, because wine grapes are America's highest value crop. Tom Collins is a wine scientist at Washington State. He said the ability to continue to make wine is at risk in areas where smoke might be more common. Cole Serrato is a researcher working on the problem in Oregon. He stood in Oregon State's vineyard near the small town of Alpine. He lit a fire and blew the smoke through a hose and into a row of grapes covered in plastic. Serrato and other researchers have done this before. They turned the treated grapes into wine. The result was the wine had an unpleasant flavor of smoke and ash. The scientists are working to find a way to keep the smoke from getting through the grape skins and creating a bad taste in the wine. Some are trying to create a process that will treat wine and remove the smokiness. But they are concerned such a process might remove some of the wine's good flavors, too. Others think they can combine smoke-affected grapes with other grapes. The mix might lessen the smoky flavor. And Collins is working on a spray made from water and a kind of clay that would protect the grapes from smoke. But all the grapes would need to be washed first before being turned into wine. Oregon State is experimenting with a similar spray treatment for grapes. In addition, the USDA has provided $7 million towards setting up smoke sensors in vineyards. Anita Oberholster is leading the efforts to save the wine grapes at UC Davis. In an internet post by UC Davis, she said, A network of sensors would help grape growers learn if their grapes are at risk. In addition, the readings from the sensors will permit the growers to prove their grapes are free from smoke damage. Winemakers are glad that the universities are working to help the industry. Greg Jones runs the Abasela Winery in Southern Oregon and is the director of the state's winemaking trade group. He said the research has gone a long way. Now the grape growers can quickly find out if the fruit has been hurt by the smoke. In the past, winemakers would not know about the wine until it was ready to drink. I think it's increasingly clear that we're not likely to find a magic bullet, Collins said. But, he said, the researchers will find ways to keep the wine business successful. I'm Dan Friedel.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore words and expressions in the English language. We give you definitions, examples, and notes on usage. Today, we talk about fitness and exercise. Keeping in shape is a common expression for staying physically fit. What sort of exercise do you enjoy? How do you get in shape? If you are already in shape, how do you stay in shape? I used to walk a lot for work, and that kept me in good shape. 5 days a week, I would walk to the train station, walk to the office, and then climb stairs. At lunch, my coworkers and I would take a walk outside. Our office is in a beautiful area of Washington, D.C., surrounded by museums and monuments. So that adds up to a lot of walking. But then in 2020, like so many others, I started working from home. I became worried that without all that walking, I would quickly get out of shape. So I made time for more swimming and short walks around my neighborhood. Those two kept me in shape. Using the word shape when talking about fitness and health makes sense. Sometimes we can describe the human body in terms of size and shape. But we can also use the word shape to talk about our projects, our activities, our actions and behaviors. So shape up also means to correct bad behavior. For example, a boss might warn an underperforming employee to shape up. The boss may take this expression one step further. She or he might add a threat by saying, shape up or ship out. Talking about ships, we also describe things that are clean or running smoothly as shipshape. A ship that is orderly and clean runs more smoothly and is safer. Remember, on a ship, you can be very far away from help. So keeping things in good order prevents accidents and big problems. So what happens if a situation or a project was in trouble but is now going well? Well, we can say things are shaping up. If it's not going well, we can say the project is in bad shape. Now let's hear two friends use some of these expressions.
Hey, how's the project going?
It's going well. Everything is ship shape now.
What do you mean, now?
Well, last week, we ran into some trouble. An employee wasn't pulling his weight, and things weren't getting done.
What did you do?
I told him, shape up or ship out.
That's pretty harsh.
Maybe, but he shaped up. Now he's a valuable member of the team. I think he was overworked and dealing with some personal issues.
We all run into trouble sometimes. Hey, talking about being overworked, let's take a break in a bit. I need a walk.
Sounds good. The project is in good shape, but I have to make sure I stay in good shape, too.
And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. We hope you enjoyed learning some shape expressions and verbal phrases. Practice using them the next time you want to talk about getting or staying physically fit. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to the Learning English Podcast. We just heard Ana Mateo discuss staying in shape. When we have changes in work routines or seasonal changes, it's important to still stay in shape. Ana is here now to talk about how she stays in shape. Welcome, Ana.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you could be here, Ana. So, okay, can you tell us again why you talked about walking and swimming in this week's episode?
Sure. This week, I discussed words and phrases that include the word shape and getting in shape and staying in shape or being out of shape. And I talked about it because we are in a seasonal change. Summer is over, fall is beginning, the weather is getting cooler. And that means sometimes our activities change too. For example, I used to swim during the summer, but now I am walking more to stay in shape.
So how did shape come to mind for this week's episode of Words and Their Stories?
Dan, shape, as you know, is such a common verbal phrase, shape up, I mean, and shape to stay in shape and out of shape. We use it for so many different situations as well, not just our physical fitness. Shape is also found in some idioms and expressions. So that's why I picked it. It is super common and super useful.
So, Ana, you talked about a few different ways that we can use the word shape in English conversation. But most of those that we've addressed so far have to do with physical fitness. Can you tell our listeners some of the other ways they can use the word shape in their phrases?
We also can describe our money situation, our finances, to be in good shape or bad shape or shaping up. Another example is if you are redecorating or rebuilding a part of your house. You could say the project is shaping up nicely or is in good shape. So again, those phrasal verbs with shape we can use for just about any situation.
So Ana, the other thing that people use the word shape with tends to come when people are using phrases related to boats or sailing. So how would you describe ship shape or this other phrase that people use, shape up or ship out?
Yeah, I included those two in my story, and they do refer to boating, the boating world. We could call that nautical. Nautical means boating and shipping, and ship shape is one of the expressions, and it describes something that is in really good working order. And experts seem to think that it comes from the fact that ships need to be clean and organized, and they need to run smoothly because they are often far from land. Now, shape up or ship out is a kind of response to something that is opposite of ship shape. If somebody is failing at a project or job, they may be asked to shape up, which means get better, or ship out, which means get fired or removed from the project.
Well, Anna, I would say that our listeners and I are definitely in better shape with our English phrases after talking with you today. So thanks again for spending some time with us. I wasn't sure how this week's episode would go, but I think it's shaped up very nicely. Thanks, Anna.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Earlier we told about his rise to power and his health problems. When he was 39 years old, FDR, as he was often called, became paralyzed from the waist down. He was never able to walk independently again. But that did not prevent him from becoming one of the country's most powerful presidents. When FDR took office, the United States was in a severe economic depression. Many farmers were not able to sell their crops for profit. Banks across the country had failed. A number of Americans lost their savings and their homes, and more than 25% of the workforce did not have a job. Yet when FDR took office in 1933, he told people, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." When Americans think of FDR, they often think of that statement. It showed his spirit of hope and confidence for which he became known. Americans also remember FDR for the way he began his presidency. In his first 100 days, he signed more than 70 bills into law. Some led to major changes in the country. They helped calm the country's banking industry, provided federal aid directly to farmers and the unemployed, and created public works programs. The acts formed the base of what FDR and others called the New Deal. Some New Deal programs, including the Civilian Conservation Corps and the Tennessee Valley Authority, created government-funded jobs. In addition to providing a paycheck for workers, the programs were meant to improve and care for the country's natural resources. For example, workers planted trees, made roads, and built dams and power plants. Americans continue to experience the effects of these programs today. FDR is also remembered for the way he communicated with the public. At that time, as many as 90% of Americans owned a radio. So, from time to time, FDR spoke to the public on radio broadcasts that became known as fireside chats. The term created an image of the president sitting comfortably near a fireplace, talking informally with a few close friends. In fact, FDR gave these talks from his office in the White House. But his voice was warm, and he spoke in an easy, conversational way to listeners, whom he called my friends. The combination of FDR's hope, energy, and affectionate concern for everyday Americans made him popular with many voters. He was reelected easily in 1936. But FDR had critics, too. Some pointed out that many of his programs failed. They cost a lot of money or were simply not effective. Others said that FDR's policy of massive government intervention was not American. It restricted capitalism and the free market. Still others observed that FDR's programs did not help everyone equally. Many New Deal programs aimed to put young, white American men to work. Women, racial minorities, and older Americans were often overlooked. Critics and supporters alike also noted that FDR greatly expanded the power of the presidency. He added a number of full-time positions to the executive branch of government, and he took on the power of Congress to make laws. Even the Supreme Court found that FDR had, in some cases, gone too far. It ruled that some of his actions were illegal. FDR worried that the Supreme Court would block many of his other New Deal programs, too. So he proposed a rule. It would give the president power to appoint 6 new members to the 9-member court. His appointments would almost certainly make sure that his New Deal programs could continue. Many historians point to FDR's efforts at court packing as one of the most extreme examples of his attempts to expand presidential power. But Congress did not accept FDR's proposal. 9 justices remained on the Supreme Court. However, those justices went on to approve FDR's actions anyway. They supported programs such as Social Security, which was set up to help older adults, disabled people, and others who needed support, and the Wagner Act, which permitted workers to organize in a trade union. While these efforts and other programs were important parts of FDR's reform efforts, they did not stop the Great Depression. None of the New Deal programs really did. The economy continued to struggle. For several years, the president had been warning lawmakers and other Americans about the political forces in Japan, Germany, and Italy. Leaders in those countries supported nationalist movements and had already invaded or taken control of other areas. By 1941, more than 30 countries were involved in the conflict. Many Americans had wanted the U.S. to remain neutral. They regretted becoming involved in World War I. For years, they had taken steps to prevent another major international conflict. Lawmakers had even banned the U.S. government from selling or giving weapons to warring countries. But FDR believed World War II was different. He believed that Germany was the clear aggressor and needed to be stopped. So, in the 1930s, FDR received permission from Congress to provide weapons to the countries opposing Germany. After Germany took control of France, FDR received permission to give direct military aid to Britain. In addition, FDR began preparing the U.S. military for war. On December 7, 1941, Japanese forces bombed American ships at the U.S. Navy base in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. More than 2,400 Americans died at Pearl Harbor, and more than 1,700 were wounded. The day after Pearl Harbor was attacked, Congress quickly approved FDR's request to declare war against Japan. 3 days later, Germany and Italy declared war on the United States. American lawmakers responded in kind. The U.S., which had remained neutral for many years, was now completely involved in World War II. During the war, FDR directed much of his attention to what would happen after the fighting stopped. he wanted to create an international order that would improve peace and cooperation. To that end, he helped organize 26 countries into a group he called the United Nations. FDR also believed that the world's future security depended, in large part, on cooperation between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. He worked hard to create friendly relations with the Soviet leader, Joseph Stalin. Stalin, FDR, and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill all famously met at the Russian town of Yalta. There, the three men discussed plans to bring World War II to an end. They decided to demand that Germany surrender unconditionally. They also talked about diplomatic relations after the war ended. At the time, many Americans believed the Yalta Conference was a success. Soviet officials agreed to enter the war against Japan. In return, U.S. officials said the Soviet government could regain control over parts of northeastern China. Soviet officials also agreed to let countries in Eastern Europe hold free elections and to share rights to veto U.N. decisions. In the eyes of many Americans, the Yalta Agreement showed that the United States and the Soviet Union would be able to cooperate. FDR did not live to see the effects of the Yalta Agreement or even the end of the conflict. He had been president for 12 years. A few weeks before the Yalta Conference, he had been sworn in yet again. FDR had already served longer than any U.S. president. All others before him had followed the custom set by the first president, George Washington. They had served no more than two terms. In the winter of 1944, FDR was beginning his fourth term. But people close to him said he did not look well. Doctors also warned Roosevelt that his health was suffering. So, in April, FDR went to a warm water resort in Georgia, where he often rested and recovered his strength. There, he suffered a cerebral hemorrhage. In other words, his brain began to bleed. World leaders, including Stalin and Churchill, said they were shocked he had died. Many Americans felt the same. They stood alongside train tracks as his body was carried from Georgia to his childhood home in New York. He is buried there at Hyde Park. In 1962, his wife Eleanor died and was buried next to him. Today, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt are important figures in U.S. history. Many programs from the New Deal are still in effect now. FDR also changed the position of president into an active, powerful leader who legally intervenes in the economy and seems to have a personal relationship with Americans. And Eleanor Roosevelt developed a strong voice of her own. Her humanitarian efforts and work on behalf of civil rights and women's rights have given her a legacy independent from her husband. Both admirers and critics point to the Roosevelts' influence as evidence of their strong feelings about the couple. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's the Learning English podcast for today. Thank you, Kelly, for that report. And thanks to our VOA colleagues for their work on today's program.
Most importantly, thank you for listening. For more, visit our website at learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedel.